I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio.
This is the second half of our interview with Martin Ford, author of The Lights in the Tunnel, Automation, Accelerating Technology, and the Economy of the Future, about the future erosion of jobs and what to do about it. Listen to the first half at IEET.org. An interesting point that I thought you made about the capital-intensive industries, given their role in this shift towards automated work, which I think in the long run for me is a beneficial one, and we'll talk about how we can make it beneficial for society. But you make the point that having payroll taxes and having benefits tied to employment, such as health insurance, is effectively a tax on labor-intensive industries that gives an unequal benefit in the market to capital-intensive industries, and that you think that that should be redressed.
Right. It's it's a problem on a couple of levels. I view it as being fundamentally unfair because it allows industries that are relatively capital-intensive to escape contributing to society. But beyond any issue of whether it's unfair, the problem is it's going to be unsustainable. I mean, those jobs are going to go away. And when the jobs go away, the benefits associated with them or the revenue for the government is also going to go away. And they're going to go away even faster because the payroll taxes create an obvious incentive to eliminate those jobs. And that's especially true even in other countries like Europe. The payroll taxes are much higher than they are here. So I view that as being unsustainable in the future, and it's going to be something that is going to happen in addition to the demographic issues that everyone already knows about. Right? We know that in the future there are going to be more and more retired people supported by fewer and fewer working people. And the assumption that everyone has made is that there are going to be jobs to support all those younger people. And I don't know if that's a good assumption. So if in addition to the demographic issue, we get into a problem where we've got serious unemployment among the younger workers, then the whole system is simply going to be unsustainable. And we've got to look at another way to finance those social problems, those social programs. And I think it should be another form of tax that falls fairly on capital-intensive industries rather than being taxed simply on workers. I mean, the taxation should be based on a business's ability to successfully extract wealth from the market. That's what the basis of taxation should be. It shouldn't be based on how many people a business happens to employ.
And that kind of a tax would slow but not stop our shift towards de-laborization of the economy.
Right. I think it would help to stabilize things, and it would help to make the social programs more sustainable. But it's certainly not going to solve the whole problem. But the immediate thing that concerns me is that we need to do something to stabilize the situation so that we don't get into a very dangerous scenario. And things like payroll taxes and in general, conservative economic policies, the things that libertarians and Republicans propose, what they're really doing is they're putting a wind at the back of this whole thing. They're pushing it forward even faster. They're causing it to accelerate, the concentration of wealth. And that's going to get this whole thing into a very dangerous area even sooner, I think.
The crisis of robotic capitalism, as it were.
Right, it could be.
Now, people have looked forward for 100 to 150 years to this kind of a prospect that automation, Marx was very concerned about it, automation might lead to a crisis of capitalism when you didn't have enough consumers relative to the concentration of capital and so forth. And there have been two basic answers, as you note. One is to give everybody the dole, to give everybody some kind of welfare. And then the question is, well, how do you generate the income from that? And you've got one of the solutions there, which is to tax these capital-intensive industries. And another group of people have argued for giving everyone some kind of job that still needs to be done. And that's where you come down pretty heavily. Now, why don't you think that giving everyone the dole is a good idea?
Well, I think that, I agree with the general argument for a guaranteed basic income. I think that at the very lowest level, we ought to provide a minimum income so that we don't have people on the street. But the idea of simply providing everyone with some kind of a flat income, even if it were a relatively generous income, and then that's it. That's the end of the story. I think it creates a lot of problems. And the problems come from the fact that, jobs, as we understand them today, have associated with them some very important incentives. And those incentives are, I think, important to people and individual people, and they're also very important to society. And the most important incentive that I would point to is the incentive to, educate yourself, you know, to go out and get an education and to try to improve yourself. I think you'd have to agree that the main incentive for going to college, for trying to making that enormous investment, both financial and in terms of all the work you have to do in order to educate yourself, is really financial. I mean, it's because you expect that you're going to have a better job or a better career and make more money, or because you're going to be able to do a job that you enjoy more and make the same money. But either way, there's the primary incentive is in terms of your career, and that's and if that incentive is taken away, if it's not there, then you know it's the number of people that are going to go out and, pursue college education and educate themselves is, I think, pretty clearly going to be dramatically lower. You're going to have people that, simply stay home and play video games all day, and that's about it. I'm not sure that, we can have a workable society if that's the reality of the future. So what I've suggested is to take this idea of some kind of a guaranteed basic income, but then tie it to incentives. So that the income that people are going to be getting is going to be unequal, and they're going to have an opportunity to pursue a higher income by pursuing education, by doing things like working in the community. I've also suggested that one very useful thing might be to tie environmental incentives into this, so that people would have an incentive to act in environmentally responsible ways, to do things that would help to battle climate change and other environmental environmental impacts. So really the general idea in economic terms is, economists have something that they call externalities. And an externality is basically something, is a type of a cost that falls on society as a whole, but it's not incorporated into individual incentives faced by people and businesses. And the biggest example of an externality right now is climate change. So really the central idea of what I'm proposing is that if in the future we're not going to be able to pay people to work in jobs and contribute directly to production, we should pay people based on externalities. We should incorporate this idea of costs that fall on society of a whole, as a whole, and we should pay people based on, their actions with regard to those costs. And then this really sort of kills two birds with one stone. First of all, it gets purchasing power into the hands of consumers, which we have to do in order to have an economy. And secondly, it begins to give us a very powerful mechanism for, addressing these externalities.
I thought your proposal that we pay people to be citizen journalists of some kind was very interesting because of the decline of journalism in our society as a career, as an occupation.
Right.
And the growth of kind of citizen journalism already, which is blogging and all of the that kind of thing.
Right, right. And I think, I honestly think that's very important because I think, you know, ultimately that's going to threaten democracy. I mean, if you look at the Constitution, it says very clearly that the government can interfere with the free press, but when those men wrote the Constitution, they didn't envision that there was going to be something else that would destroy the press, and that it would be, you know, technology and the internet. Democracy can't work without some scrutiny, you know. And the main danger right now, I think, is at the local level. There's still obviously national journalists focused on what's happening in Washington, but what about all the small towns and cities? I mean, as local newspapers disappear, who is going to be watching the city council? Who's going to be looking out for corruption at the local level? I mean, bloggers can pick that up to a certain extent, I think, but it's not clear to me that local bloggers really have the reach and the power to focus on that. So I really think the government at some point will probably need to get involved and actually directly support journalism in some way to make sure that it's still, you know, exists as a method of scrutinizing and, weeding out corruption.
So an end point, some point in this century that you imagine in the book is where we might have an economy where 25% of the working population, working age population is working at a private sector job of some kind. And then another 25% might be on the dole, basically doing basic income guarantee, living on their basic income guarantee. And then another half of the working age population might be through some working through some public sector kind of employment, being paid to be a student, as you said, or a journalist, or doing some kind of community or civic work. Is that the kind of scenario that we're talking about?
That's roughly it. I mean, I don't know about the percentages. Obviously, when you're imagining, you know, decades in the future, I mean, any exact percentages are pretty meaningless. But I think there's going to be some mix of people that continue to do traditional jobs, and I think that the way I envision it in the future, most people who are really working hard at private sector jobs like we have today are going to be doing that primarily on an entrepreneurial basis. They're going to be doing it because they think they can get a strong return for it. There isn't going to be much need for people in the private sector to do average routine jobs. I mean, machines will take care of that. There will still be jobs left for people doing uniquely human things, you know, working with children, working in the community, this type of thing. So there's going to be a mix there, but I think that there's absolutely going to be a need to provide some sort of a supplementary income stream. I mean, that, you know, this idea that we have now where people are paid to do jobs, people are paid to participate in production is just not going to be workable because machines are going to be able to do that better and cheaper than people. So there'll be a mix of people doing different things, but there will have to be a supplementary income for consumers.
So to get from where we are today to that point, you make the argument that we don't want to have revolution, we don't want to have people starving in the streets, we don't want to have all these terrible cataclysmic changes to be required to get there. So we need some incremental public policy. And one of the things that you argue for is job sharing as a policy that the government would have to mandate to encourage some stability, declining amount of our work life devoted to labor, but some sharing of the employment that's out there.
Right. I think that's sort of an obvious thing to do. I think other people have talked about things like potentially reducing the number of hours in the work week. I think we could have something more elaborate. I actually imagine perhaps some internet application that allows businesses to share workers. I think it could be in large corporations, it could be done internally. In smaller businesses, there could be some sort of market set up so that people share jobs. But the important thing is I think it's going to have to be done through government regulation. And as I said, there's going to have to be an additional income stream as well, because it's obvious that if you look at what's happening with part-time employment right now, it doesn't generate enough income. People can't survive. I mean, people who are doing part-time jobs now, they take two or three part-time jobs if they can find them so that they can get by. So the idea is that we want to reduce the amount of hours that people are working, but at the same time, we're going to offer them an additional income stream so that they have a sufficiently high income, you know, so that they can go out there and be viable consumers.
So government subsidies for employing people include in your book not only government actually giving some kind of a subsidy to a business to hire somebody, but also reducing the burdens on business that do hire people. So the burdens of health insurance and pensions all tied to employment.
Right. Again, that's sort of the same idea as getting rid of the payroll taxes. I think we should migrate that stuff so that it falls fairly on capital-intensive industries and it's not just a burden on businesses that happen to employ people. We've got to find a mechanism where our overall economic activity supports our social programs like healthcare and provides income for consumers so that they can get out there and be viable consumers. Because otherwise, we're just not going to have broad-based consumer demand.
See, the libertarians and the singularitarians are going to scream bloody murder because they're going to say, well, we're never going to get to a society where everyone has a basic income guarantee and where robots are doing all the hard labor if you keep taxing business this way, if you keep imposing these kinds of government regulations. So these are all going to stand in the way of this inevitable march of progress that they keep talking about.
Well, yeah, they won't like it, but I think that what I just don't understand really why they don't see that if we don't have consumer demand, they're also not going to get where they think they're going to get. If we don't address this issue, I don't believe there's going to be a technological singularity. I don't believe it will happen. I don't believe we will get to these fantastic technologies that people are envisioning. And the reason is that technological advance is tied very closely to economic growth, and it's going to take enormous investment to get to that point. I mean, if these kind of technologies that people like Kurzweil are imagining are going to take enormous trillions and trillions of dollars of investment to get to that place. That investment won't occur if people look to the future and they see that we don't have a vibrant economy. I mean, people build technologies like that because they believe they can sell them. And if there's no one out there to buy those technologies, to buy the products and the services that are produced, then it's simply not going to happen. I don't believe it will happen.
Now, you also point to one of the major barriers in getting the kind of policies, the foresightful policies that you promote in the book, which are just, I think, right smack on the kind of policies that we need. But any attempt to lobby for those policies in Washington runs up against the tremendous power of concentrated wealth and corporate lobbying in Washington, D.C., and you talk about that.
Right. It's a very serious problem. One of my motivations in writing this book was I hoped that I could get this message out there so that maybe some of those wealthy people, powerful people, would end up reading the book, and they would see that, in the long run, the policies that they're advocating are really not in their interest. I mean, the problem with these people is that they're selfish, but they're selfish in fundamentally a stupid way, at least in the long term. People tend to be very selfish, and they tend to be very selfish in a short-term kind of way. But these kind of policies are ultimately going to destroy the future for everyone, not just for regular people, but for the wealthy as well. But in terms of how we can get around that, there was a proposal I read about from economist Alan Blinder, and he basically said we ought to take the details of the tax code and get that away from Congress and put it in an agency similar to the Federal Reserve. And I honestly think that kind of idea, although a lot of people will object to that and they will argue that it's not democratic, I think that it may be the kind of model we're going to have to shift to in the future. The democracy is a good thing, but maybe too much direct democracy where every single detail, every issue is open to debate by everyone, and in particular where every detail can be influenced by people that have an enormous amount of power, isn't going to be workable, and it's not flexible enough. In the future, we're going to need a government that can respond very quickly. If you look at the financial crisis that's unfolded over the last year, I think there's going to be a lot more of that in the future. And the general reason there's going to be more is that technology is advancing. Technology is a kind of amplifier that is going to cause a lot more volatility, not just in financial markets, but in overall society. We're going to have a government that can respond quickly to all kinds of crises that might evolve. And I think the way to do that is probably to get the details of how government is run away from Congress and away from the lobbyists and center them in agencies like the Federal Reserve that have a fair amount of authoritarian power and that are run by technocrats, essentially. And a lot of people won't like that, but as a matter of reality, I think that's probably something that will have to happen if we're going to make it through the coming decades.
Well, one of the arguments that you make in the book is that our current economic crisis, the 2008-09 meltdown, was significantly contributed to by automation of trading and other kinds of information and communication technologies. But,
right.
But that also the shift towards a basic income guarantee plus public sector employment plus these kinds of supplemented income streams from federal dollars would stabilize the economy against these kinds of cyclical trends.
That's right. It would tend to stabilize it because basically it would get away from this idea that consumers are getting their income from jobs. Because when we get into an economic situation like this, the jobs disappear and we get into essentially a negative feedback cycle, right? Where job losses drive down consumption, which then drives down job losses even more. If you were able to decouple consumption from jobs, then you'd have a much more stable situation. And I think that's one of the primary things we want to try to do in the future.
Martin, I think that this is a book everyone should be reading, and you've written it in an incredibly accessible way because I think because you decided to just sit down and write it instead of spend 10 years trying to master every single detail. So I highly recommend this as an introduction to this topic. It's a great starting point for this debate. The Lights in the Tunnel, Automation Accelerating Technology in the Economy of the Future by Martin Ford. So are you working on anything else?
Well, I'm going to be working on the blog. I don't have another book plan. I'm really working hard on marketing this one. My hope for this book was that it would really get beyond this particular group of people that listens to this kind of show and thinks about these issues.
Hey, don't knock my audience, man.
No. I'm not.
We're opinion leaders.
That's right. But I think it's very important to get this message out to the people that don't necessarily spend a lot of time thinking about these issues. And that's one of the things I tried to do with this book.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
This has been the second half of our interview with Martin Ford, author of The Lights in the Tunnel, Automation, Accelerating Technology, and the Economy of the Future. To hear the first half of our interview, go to IEET.org. We could go back in history to any number of forebears who have predicted a jobless economy as a result of automation and tried to figure out what kinds of society we should have if that comes about. But we happen to have a 1966 interview with Chet Huntley of the NBC program Chet Huntley Reporting, which was a longtime show on NBC in the 1960s. And here he's interviewing I.A. Lewis. So let's listen to this.
Now, how about the technology that put John Citizen in this position? Will it really be so different? I.A. Lewis, called Bud, thinks so. He's the computer expert in the NBC News Elections Unit, and his thinking ranges far into the future. He attributes almost magical powers to the computer, while at the same time describing it as an idiot machine. We put the question, if what you say about the machines be true, we're going to be left with a lot of leisure on our hands, right?
I believe so. I really do. It seems to me that the progress of our economy over the last 50 years or so has been tending in this direction, and the computer has only tended to throw it over the cliff. It seems to me that the computer will replace a large number of skilled workmen so that you will have, as we do now, factories which once employed hundreds or even thousands of people, supervised by 2 or 3 or 4 or 20 or 30 people, all of whom do nothing but supervise computers.
Well, what will the others be doing?
My opinion is that we are going to have to readjust our old Puritan, perhaps, concepts of what a person should do with his life. We used to believe that work was ennobling, that a man who devoted himself to hard work was in some way virtuous. Now it seems to me that what is required is a different attitude toward what a man should do with his life, because there's not going to be all the jobs that used to be around.
Well, are you saying that we may have to develop a society in which we might conclude that non-work is ennobling?
Exactly. Well, my feeling is, and of course I can't be sure, that there are the germs of this solution here now. You'll notice that the one idea which engages the youth of America now is something like a Peace Corps. There is a kind of a feeling that a person should dedicate his life to other people, not towards manufacture of material things, but toward the spiritual concepts. In other words, you may almost find a society which has a different a quasi-religious attitude, which is not on faith, but on good works. I think there are perhaps some great benefits to derive from all of this. Let's be utterly frank about it. Who in the world really likes to work? Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could convince yourself that it wasn't the right thing to work?
Well, Cotton Mather told me it was wonderful to work, and I'm still am inclined to believe him.
Well, I think most Americans would agree with you. I do believe, however, that the pursuit of pure science, the pursuit of good works for my fellow man, could be a very satisfying way of devoting a life.
Well, all right. But who's going to hew the wood and draw the water now?
Well, I've already suggested that the computer is going to play a large part in this. You see, my feeling is that we are in the midst of a second industrial revolution, or an electronical revolution. It is the information, that ingredient, is what the computer will add to the manufacturing process and replace the worker who has been more and more shoved into the skilled category to provide that, because actual labor is very little required anymore.
The skilled labor will be fixing the machines, in other words.
Right.
Well, then, will there be a need for anyone to make decisions, to guide the machines, tell them what to do?
Very definitely. There will come out of this a electronic elite, if you like. There will be the society of the computer programmer, the man who will tell the machine how to perform its task. The thing about a computer is that it is the first, I think, universal machine. It is the machine which can perform any task. As a matter of fact, it doesn't even know what it's supposed to do until you tell it what to do. Well, what the telling of a machine of what it's to do, that is the program. And it is the programmer who really controls the means of production. It seems to me that if we must have, as I suggested before, an ethos in which work is not important, then we must also have a kind of a noblesse oblige in which certain electronic elite people realize it as their duty to help to supervise the economy.
Well, Bud, it seems to me you're still crediting these machines with unusual powers. These machines cannot produce new information. They can only distribute faster old information, right?
Well, I think you're right, but I'm not entirely sure. In other words, they certainly do process information at an incredible rate. And as a matter of fact, the computer is frequently referred to as an idiot machine, the kind of machine which can perform only 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 or 15 different functions, but it does it like a bandit. On the other hand, there seems to be a suggestion that, depending on how you define it, that a computer can learn. That perhaps, depending on what you mean by it, a computer can think. And it already seems possible, as a matter of fact, it's been demonstrated theoretically, that computers can reproduce themselves.
The mating song of the computer, actually sung by one of the so-called idiot machines.
Again, that was Chet Huntley interviewing I.A. Lewis 2 years before 2001, A Space Odyssey was released. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.